taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome back. That big smokestack over there is Clayton Hunt, the only real libertarian. .com. TM. Inc. What's going on, man?
Not much. Just went out today. I know we were talking about how, like, I've been listening to a bunch of audiobooks recently. Not much, really. I mean, I've just been doing activism and working and all that wonderful stuff.
Activism, all the things. What's that shirt you got on, man? Let's check that out. It's pretty awesome.
It says, and let me take my flannel off so you can see the actual shirt better. Might see the artwork in my room, but sometimes reasonable men must do unreasonable things. Killdozer.
You're goddamn right. What's the story behind that for anyone who doesn't know?
So basically, there was a guy in, I believe it was Colorado, and he owned a muffler shop for years, and a big concrete plant was going in next door, and the city council basically was like, tax revenue. Yes. And they saw the large tax revenue coming from that big concrete plant, but they didn't really care that much about this guy. It was Heermeyer, his muffler shop that had been a part of the community for years. So he went to the city council. He tried to fight it because what they wanted to do was cut off his access from the road so that no one could actually get to his muffler shop. And he fought it for years. He fought it through city council. He said, you know, if you're cool with it, I'll make my own, like, access to the road. Like, he bought a bulldozer. He said, look, I'll do it myself. You don't even have to pay anything. I'll do it. And they said no, repeatedly. Because, again, they wanted that concrete plant. I think the idea was to expand onto his muffler shop and just kind of run him out of business so that he'd have to sell and so that the big concrete plant could take his land. And so after fighting for years, asking for permission, saying, please let me keep my business open, my livelihood open, and basically when he found out, you know, I think they ended up cutting off his sewer, they ended up cutting off his power, and just said, screw you, dude, get the message, hit the road. He basically made a custom armor for the bulldozer and went out and bulldozed through the homes and businesses of those who were on the city council who had done him wrong and targeted specifically those businesses and those things that were the city councils and were the property of the city. And eventually he fell through the basement in one of them and he didn't make it out alive. But as Marvin Heermeyer is an American hero.
Some of the footage of this on screen right now. So we're watching like Channel 4 news with the killdozer driving around. It kind of reminds me of the, what was that? The Jawas tank thing that they had, the droid factory. From a certain like angle.
The stain crawler?
Yeah, the big gray one, you know, where Obi-Wan's like, oh, that marksmanship is far too good for sand people.
Which, I'll tell you this. So, everyone is always like, oh, the stormtroopers are bad shots. what if they're not bad shots, but they are intentionally missing so that they can keep an eye on rebel cells? Think about that.
That's an interesting theory. And of course there's somebody else, I'm sure, who has a theory that, like, oh, they weren't missing. It was, there's another Jedi that you don't know about who's watching everything and steering light beams with his mind.
Well, that could be Snoke. I mean, if you want to go meta, but I remember hearing this was a fan theory. You have to understand. So in Star Wars, the stormtroopers aren't like your regular troops. These are like your elite, like, troops. These are like your special forces guys, right? Really? There's a lot of them because it's like a galaxy of, you know, quadrillions. And so you imagine, like, the special forces and, like, a population of quadrillions would be a lot of troops. But basically, these were, like, specialty high-level troops. So for them to miss like that doesn't make sense. You know, you, like, in, I know they said, like, in Solo, like, you see, like, those guys that are, like, sitting there in the mud. Those are your regular Imperial troops. Stormtroopers are not that. Stormtroopers are, they're, like, higher level. So the idea was that they were actually intentionally missing because they wanted to keep an eye on those rebels, because essentially they were tracking rebellion throughout the galaxy. And whenever they saw something like that, they would intentionally miss so that they could track them.
Interesting. Man, now you got me thinking about Clerks and the let's have a tax conversation about Star Wars. How did they raise enough revenue to build the Death Star? And how did they do it? Because
broad tax base.
What's that?
You imagine, again, it's a broad tax base. I mean, you're taxing an entire galaxy. The U.S. government only taxes, like, 300-something million people.
Right.
And look at all the crazy shit they spend money on, right?
But you had the so there was, like, this intergalactic council who didn't approve of this project, apparently. And so how did they get the money for it if this wasn't on the official budget? Like, was there, like,
well, that
some...
was the Senate.
Was the Senate for this project? I thought they were against it.
No, they were against it. But that's why, like, in like, A New Hope, they mentioned that Palpatine did away with the Senate. Because really, the Senate was just kind of like a figurehead, a bastion of the old Republic, and then they got rid of it. But if you look at what was it, the one that was before Solo, the Star Wars story, Rogue One, right? So basically they've already built the Death Star in that time. Basically they, so someone mentioned, and I know it was in the news recently, that the Air Force had like $1,200 coffee mugs, right? And people were going like, oh, that's a giant waste. How would you spend $1,200 for a coffee mug? But if you remember watching Independence Day, they mentioned, like, when they've got, like, the alien ship, right, and all this crazy secret stuff. You didn't really think we spent $30,000 on a hammer, right? It was, the Death Star was a secret research project by the Imperial military. Basically, I imagine they didn't have to budget for that. They just had to budget, like, regular wasteful spending, and we see it in our current system. The government gets away with it. They're jobbing massive amounts of money.
How much has the Pentagon lost over the years? That's just not accounted for. That's not even the money they didn't spend on hammers and toilet seats. That's the money they just say, well,
oopsie.
Yeah. We went to the ATM one day, we pulled out $20 trillion, and yeah, we don't know what it could have been on cocaine and hookers for all we know.
It probably was. At least a good portion was probably cocaine and hookers.
I could see them spending knowing the government on that. I mean, that's a lot of money, but you figure there's a lot of them that were in on this. And you gotta give them a lot of money to keep them quiet, right?
True.
Oliver North wasn't a dummy. Man.
Which, you think about it, he's like, isn't Oliver North the head of the NRA now?
Is he?
Or at least like the figurehead? I think he is.
It would make sense. I mean, he never went to prison or anything for the shit he did.
Oliver North. Well, we know he's a good gun salesman.
I'm sure. Lieutenant Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, poised to become NRA president. Let's see what this says. I'm gonna bring my Safari back up here. Ooh, last chance! I can renew my membership at special rates that will never be offered again.
Oh, special rates for NRA membership?
Let's see. Where's I clicked on a specific article, and it just took me to like the homepage to sign up. What's going on here? What can you got to scroll all the way down to
all the NRA. Yeah, because all the NRA is a money making operation. They don't fight for rights.
Jeez. Yeah, this thing has more ads on it than Salon.
Yeah, no, like that's really like. The NRA is essentially in the business of selling people, you know, and being scared that the government's coming to take their guns. And they can't do that unless they concede to the government on taking people's guns.
I'm seriously, hold on a second. I'm seriously on their website thinking I'm reading an article and it's an ad. Like,
yeah.
Seriously, this is like. The NRA is just fucking, like, big clickbait. Okay, here we go.
They are.
The logic of the NRA choosing Ollie North as president. Why would a group select the Iran-Contra figure as the new leader? Because its strategy of defensiveness and stalemate has worked well so far. Okay. In 94, he ran for U.S. Senate in Virginia. That's interesting. Where he proved a formidable fundraiser. Oh, that's why the NRA wants him. But a divisive candidate. That's probably also why they want him. He lost. Wait. Okay, hold on. This is interesting. He lost to incumbent Chuck Robb, helped by a third-party candidate who was endorsed by Senator John Warner. How do you think a third party candidate would help another candidate win? This is like already, this is back in 1994 and they're already claiming the spoiler effect. Well, I guess this article is new, but
I mean, you have to understand that. Yeah, no. So I do Uber and Lyft, and I was already dealing with this earlier today because I picked up someone, and my playlist when I'm doing Uber it's either like Motown or George Strait. And today was George Strait, and the song Blame It on Mexico came up, and I made the joke to my passenger that this was going to be Trump's 2020 campaign theme song, Blame It on Mexico.
Oh man. What do you say?
Which she thought it was funny, but she was definitely to the left on the idea of spoiler effects, and she was like, you know, I mentioned like I'm a libertarian and third party stuff, and she's like, well, but third parties, that's how you make sure Trump wins again. And I had to explain to her, like, you know, ma'am, like, really it comes down to if it comes down to the Democrat versus like random Democrat versus random Republican and there's no libertarian in the race, I'm voting for Harambe again. I don't see a point in voting for any of these other ones. The only Democrat I could conceivably, possibly, even hold my nose and vote for would be Tulsi Gabbard. And even then, I probably wouldn't anyways.
I remember seeing her, and she said a couple interesting things, but then I was like, okay, let me just go look up her platform. Let me do that. This is going to be the thing of the day. I'm just like Googling stuff and showing it on screen. Tulsi Gabbard. This is the one.
Well,
from
and the only reason why I would, She's from Hawaii, I think.
Yeah.
Like the only good thing that I can say about her is I think she's consistently anti-war. That's good, but I don't think any of that her other policy positions are anything spectacular. That's the thing. Like,
but I think she has.
I would.
So like when I first looked her up, paradox for the left. Let me find like the most right-leaning news source I can and see what they have to say about her. I think she was like. She was like anti-LGBT or something.
Oh, yeah.
Or something.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
That might not have been it, but she was something that was like very. No, that wouldn't have been because she's a Democrat, right? Is she a Democrat?
There's plenty of. Remember, Democrats have only been pro-LGBT since like 2013.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been pro-gay rights for a long time. So, I mean, if she's existed politically or even just as a person before 2013, I mean, she probably has something bad to say about gay people just because that is how the Democrats are. You know, they love to say, oh, yeah, Pride, we're here, we love you now. But, you know, like 6-7 years ago wasn't so. And it's but with her, it's specifically anti-war. That's it. Is that she's really good on war, and then everything else is just a dumpster fire. But as opposed to just all the other Democratic candidates, which are just straight dumpster fires.
Oh, here we go. She was born in American Samoa. That's not one of the United States.
Okay.
Is she qualified?
Territory.
Are they gonna ask for her birth certificate as a territory?
They probably will.
Do they issue social security numbers?
They probably numbers? Will. I don't know, but likely is they're probably gonna ask for her birth certificate or some bullshit like that.
Right. Yeah, they'll give her hell for something. And anybody hold me to that anti-LGBT thing. Like, I just remember I read something about her and I was like, ugh, that's gross. I don't remember what it was. That might have been some other candidate. I don't pay too much attention to these guys because I'm like, they're all full of shit. They're all gonna come and rob us and make a big government and screw us all over.
Yep.
Left and right. Yeah. It's
which is funny because Thomas Massie, the Liberty Republican darling. There was this thing going around of him saying that if they build the wall unconstitutionally, then it protects nothing at all. But I remember I saw the other day, like, there was a tweet, and it was like, you know, he supports building the wall. He supports Donald Trump, but, like, just wants to do it this, you know, just pay for it through Congress, man. Just do all the terrible things through Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So libertarian. So libertarian.
Kind of like full circle back to Oliver North. Congress wouldn't let him spend the money, so he did some fundraising of his own. I mean, he didn't
exactly.
He didn't threaten anybody. He created a new business venture selling cocaine to Americans.
And then, you know, but hey, I mean, really in the end, the guy was a great gun salesman, you know. He knows his way around weapons. That's why the NRA got him. They know he's got a record of weapons getting into people's hands.
Yeah. Well, they say the same about Terrible Obama. People.
Oh, yeah, true. I mean,
anyone in California, right?
I remember it was during the El Chapo trial? Like, the prosecution was trying to get, like, the coverage of things like Fast and Furious. Like, excluded from the trial, like they couldn't talk about that because it made the U.S. government look really bad. Because like part of it was like, look, he's got all these crazy weapons and he's getting smuggling weapons into the country.
Where did he get them from?
Where did he get them from? I don't know. Gun show loophole. That's the gun show loophole right there.
Yeah,
that's what it is. Totally gun show loophole.
He started a sweatshop in Mexico, and he was building these guns on his own.
Oh no, he started a gun show in Mexico, and see, by the magic of the gun show loophole, when you start a gun show, basically weapons just enter people's hands.
Murderers just show up there, and that's absolutely insane. You know, this reminds me of like my favorite friend was a lawyer trying this case of this guy who was caught like selling like 40 kilos of coke. So closing arguments, my friend gets up there and he's like, so you see, he's being charged with conspiracy to sell drugs or whatever, traffic, whatever. Well, the crime of conspiracy requires that two or more people get together and sell the drugs. Now, there are three people involved in this case. One of them was not involved in buying or selling, and the other one was a government informant, so he does not count. So, my client, although he was very ambitious in his goal to buy and sell 40 kilos of cocaine, is not guilty of this crime. And the verdict was not guilty.
Well, but you have to admit, though, he was guilty of one thing. Impersonating a CIA official.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, the government doesn't like it when you encroach on their territory.
Yeah.
This is our corner.
It's our turf. Yeah.
Man. Okay, so I asked you about this earlier. Alex Jones. Did you see Alex Jones last night? And okay, maybe I just got reminded this because David Foster just posted DMT in the comments. That's awesome, man. Have you ever tried DMT? Okay, so Joe Rogan had Alex Jones on last night, and there were like all these like ridiculous clips showing up. And like, I don't know how long his show normally is. I think it's like an hour or two. And so I'm like, what is going on here? So I go over to YouTube and I Google it, and I see like a 4-hour clip come up, and this is what's weird. I start watching it and it's like, they're already, I thought it was like live. And I was like, they were 4 hours in. Cause they, as soon as I turned it on, they were like in the middle of a conversation and they were already like going at it. And then I realized, like, an hour later, I'm like, how long is this thing going to go on? Now it's been 5 hours. And then I look, and I'm like, no, I'm 1 hour into a 4-hour clip. And that's not even the whole thing. Oh, my God. And and Alex Jones is just going off like a fucking maniac. And he said some pretty real stuff, too, which is pretty cool. But so what I thought was really interesting was when – So you know, Joe finally gets a hold of the conversation for a minute, and he starts talking, and you know, usually like Alex will just kind of interrupt, but you know, Alex was taking a little break here, so Joe was talking, and it was kind of off camera, but enough where you could see where it was, and Alex Jones is like, he's got a handle of some kind of rum over here, and he's like pouring it into his mug, and I'm just like, oh, this is awesome. And then there was another part where you just see like all this smoke coming in from off screen from Joe Rogan's side. Like, I don't know if he was smoking. It didn't look like vape smoke. It looked like cigar smoke. Like, it was kind of like more like, you know, it wasn't like puffy cloudy. It was like wavy.
Cigar smoke.
Yeah. So, man, I was like, this is an interesting, I kind of want to watch the rest of it. And it was weird because, you know, Alex Jones is like, he's right about a lot of stuff, but even the stuff he's right about, he says it in such a crazy way you don't want to believe him.
I mostly just wish Alex Jones would go back to being Bill Hicks. Like, I liked his Bill Hicks stuff better than the Alex Jones bit. And it's gone a little too long. Yeah. I mean, come on. Like, let's bring back Bill Hicks.
But I mean, I guess it's working for him. He made a really good point. So, because I've been following Joe Rogan, like, over the last month, like, a little bit more closely. And he's got, like, I don't know how many millions of followers on YouTube. And Alex Jones was basically pointing out, look, like, Alex Jones was big, right? Even if you think he's crazy, like, you don't believe anything he says, he was big. He had millions of followers. And when all the social media sites shut him down, that really was huge, because there were, like, millions of people following him. And he compared himself to, like, CNN, which, like, you know, CNN Nightly News, like, maybe back in the 90s had, you know, I don't know, based on his stats, he said, like, 10 million views, like, at a time, and now they're down to a million, which is still pretty high. And then you look at, like, you know, Joe Rogan's, it tells you right there how many live viewers he's got, and it's, like, 50,000. You know, it's not a million, but it's huge. It's like, you know, they were talking about, like, all these other shows, like Daily Show, which has more viewers than CNN. And...
So, like, I would say, like, for Joe Rogan, especially because he does, like, a podcast, right? I would look at his downloads after the fact more than necessarily the live viewers.
Right.
Because, you know, if his thing is, like, he's creating something that can be viewed later, that's where you're going to see the actual impact of what his message is.
And if you do that, like, some of his videos – I'm going to go to his channel right now. Some of his videos have millions of views. And that's not something you can do with CNN. It's like they have their live count, and then that's it. Like, I mean, yeah, like, sometimes people pull little clips and things, and they probably make some of it available offline. But let me – I'm going to put this back on the screen. Okay, so his this isn't even his official. He's got David Lee Roth on today.
Okay.
So he's got 190,000 views, and this started an hour ago. The Alex Jones has 3.6 million views, and it's almost 24 hours later.
Yeah.
So that's, like, that is massive. And so, you know, and so Alex Jones's point was, you know, Joe Rogan's not owned by some parent company or by his advertisers or anything like that. Actually, that's a good point. He doesn't even have I'm sure he gets, like, a couple sponsorships here and there, but he's not really, like, loaded up with commercials or anything.
Yeah.
Is he? I don't think I haven't seen him. I saw him pitch. He wasn't even pitching. He had someone on his show talking about, like, this, like, mouth breather thing for working out or I don't know, something like that. But that wasn't even, like, I mean, unless he's charging people to come on his show, like he's charging Alex Jones. No, that doesn't make sense. I don't know how he's making, like, maybe he's just making money from the YouTube ads, whatever YouTube does.
He might be doing ad revenue, because, I mean, imagine, especially millions. Someone with that amount of viewers and all that, like, how, and likely not going to get demonetized because he's, like, considered at least acceptable by the mainstream, you know, he could probably make money through that.
All right, I'm gonna see. Well, no, I don't wanna. I'm not gonna mess with that right now. I don't. If I tried to play one of these clips, no one would see the audio or no one would hear the audio. And whoever said DMT, they would be able to see the audio. let's see. Rod Weber's in the comments going crazy. Rogan is owned by Onnit. What's Onnit?
Onnit? Oh, okay.
With two N's.
They also sponsor, what's its face? Daniele Bellali, who does History on Fire.
Joe Rogan Onnit.
It's like O-N-N-I-T. I think they do, like, supplements and workout stuff. That's probably it.
So is this like, but this is like, and oh yeah, he's all over this thing. That's a great face shot right there. I know you can't see this.
But it's probably like Audible, where, you know, if you listen to like 20 podcasts, you'll hear Audible like sponsoring like 10 of them, like half of them. And then like, or it'll be like like, especially YouTube now, like a bunch of different channels that I follow. It's VPN services. Like, all these different VPNs are just like, hey, buy our products.
The NSA is watching your every move. Get a VPN, which is owned by the NSA. Yeah. no, So J.C. Cook is saying, like, yeah, it's that super male vitality. That's actually a really good point, because that's what Alex Jones was selling. And so, like, now Joe Rogan. But I guess, what are the odds? Because it's just, like, a popular thing that everyone's selling Viagra and steroids.
I think super male vitality is, like, Alex Jones's, like, personal proprietary stuff. Because, like, I know he sells water filters. Because all Alex Jones really is just a simple water filter salesman.
It's simple, honest work. What is it? It's
selling water filters.
Yeah, it's a simple job, but it's honest work. Yeah. So Joel's saying Rogan's probably getting paid by the elitists, and that's why he had a feud with Jones. Illuminati. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. I mean, it's always possible. Who the fuck knows, right? Well, I mean, if I were
in a... Like, I mean, Rogan is but that's not his, like, main job. Doesn't he do, like, UFC, mostly?
I don't know if he still does it. He does still do stand-up comedy, but I can't imagine he makes a whole shitload doing that. But yeah, I mean...
I don't know, like...
I mean, well, he had a Netflix special. I'm sure he makes good money doing all that stuff. It's but you know, yeah, so to that point, like, you know, if the Illuminati came along and said, look, we know you're only making $1 million a year, how would you like to make $1 billion a year? And maybe he might say, well, maybe. And like, maybe they have some way of doing it where it's like, because here's the thing, right? If the Illuminati did exist and did want to have influential people on their payroll, they would want people who wouldn't be obvious.
True.
And it's not to say that everyone's a sellout, but, you know, they could put some feelers out there, they could find someone, and, yeah, who knows?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I'm waiting on my check for this month from the Illuminati.
I don't think he's, yeah, can you, like, how do you apply for that job?
I could use it's not a job that you apply for. They've got like recruiters and stuff like that. Kind of like corporate headhunting and stuff like that. A little on that side.
Well, could you give him my resume? I need to fund this campaign.
Maybe. They reach out through LinkedIn. That's the thing. They always go through LinkedIn.
I gotta go. LinkedIn is the
social network of the Illuminati. That's all you need to know.
Theft is Jesus, says Rod Weber.
See, Facebook is the reptilian overlords. LinkedIn is the Illuminati. Reddit is the transdimensional aliens, alien child monsters that Alex Jones warned you about. He was right. It's Reddit. I forgot what Tumblr was. Rothschilds. Tumblr's Rothschilds. I'm pretty sure.
Interesting. So that's why they shut down my taxation as theft post so fast.
Oh, Tumblr? Oh, they probably...
Well, Reddit,
they
mostly.
Probably heard that... Oh, Reddit? Okay, I don't think if it was Tumblr,
yeah.
They probably saw the acronym and they were like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. There's no adult content allowed on standards. This side, but... Fucko.
Oh, man.
This is a Christian website, boy. You can't have none of that TIT on here.
Man. Is it? Is it really?
Oh, God. They did it last year. And from what I heard, it was like just a preparing for Sesta Fosta. A lot of sex workers would have like a Tumblr blog and would post adult content on there. And they were like... Uh-oh, what happens when Sesta Fosta starts kicking in? We're in trouble, so no more adult content.
But that's not illegal content. I thought that, like, those were supposed to be against, like, soliciting sex work or something like that.
But if the thing was that it's really hard, especially with that, like, large amount of users, to differentiate who's soliciting sex work and who's just, like, pervert, posting porn. So it's easy just to say, nope, no adult content.
So I'm just trying to think here. if any website can be held accountable because somebody posts an ad, does that mean that if, I'm just trying to think of like an outrageous example that would violate that law that we could go after somebody for that we don't like. If you go to the post office and they have like a cork board there with like all kinds of different ads and updates and things, and you post an ad with a pin on that cork board that says for a good time call and a phone number and maybe some pictures, could you sue the United States Post Office under FOSTA?
I don't know.
I mean,
figure that one out. Actually,
they created the billboard. They didn't take it down. It's there. Damage is done.
Now, does it only apply to digital boards? And that might be the issue.
Okay. Then
kind of like, you know, if you posted like a copyrighted image on that same board, would that fall under the DMCA, or would that be another thing?
Okay, hear me out. You drill a hole in the wall and you stick in a USB stick, which happens to have all kinds of ads for prostitution on it. And you fill in the hole with cement so that the USB stick is there. So anybody who wants to can go plug their laptop into the USB stick sticking out of the wall and download the ads.
I mean,
now it's digital.
I mean, maybe. I think the one thing you might... I don't know how you could get the post office, but like, let's just say
send it by mail.
Again, I don't know if it has to be digital. I'm
okay.
Not sure. I'm not an expert on Sesta Pasta. I just know it's shit. But I mean,
okay,
you could do like
email
Miller's
it
through the post.
Email it to everybody who works at the FBI. Now it's in their emails. And it's hosted on their mail
server. And they do have email servers.
Yeah. And it's all electronic.
It's a mail server.
It doesn't matter if they purchase or not. The ad has been posted. It's in their mailboxes.
True.
They must prosecute themselves.
Now, well, wait. Remember, this is the same FBI that operated a website, a child pornography website, for like a long time. And not only did they operate the child pornography website, they intentionally grew the member base, so they were distributing more child porn than the guy that they had popped over it, and not a single one of these assholes, which under the law, that counts as distributing child porn. You know, none of these sick fucks that did that shit are ever going to see the inside of a jail cell.
Right.
So remember, there's that government employee privilege.
Above the law.
Yeah.
The untouchables.
They are the law. Yeah.
I don't know why. I'm just, screw it. I'm just going to go work for the FBI. I can do whatever I want. Or the CIA.
I mean, you don't even have to go the FBI route. You just work at your local police department. You can get away with murder.
Yeah, you know what? It needs to be CIA because I'm not even in the U.S. So the CIA is the only one you can do that.
The thing is, I live in Houston, right? And remember that whole that drug raid? I mean, essentially, Houston police officers can get away with murder. Looks like it.
They have. They
murdered a couple.
They're doing it over and over again.
Yeah. Criticize them. They got your number, buddy. They're going to start watching you.
Oh, what was that case that I saw yesterday about what was it? There was a case about whether or not to release, I think it was a police's, an officer's, like his complaint history.
I'm not sure.
During a trial. I saw something like this. And whenever I see that stuff, I'm really pissed off because I'm like, look, these guys, you know, they'll say we're not allowed to see how many complaints have been filed against an officer and it's for officer's safety. When those officers have, and I'm not talking about the good cops, I'm talking about the bad cops. Those bad cops have access, and we know they exist. Like, it's not just a few bad apples, it's a lot of bad apples. They have access to all of our information. Like, they this is how insane it is. It's against the law to have a driver's license that does not have your current address on it. So if you piss yep. off one of those bad cops, he can find you. He knows where you are, unless you're illegally driving yep. with an old address on your license. But for an officer, they won't even tell you their names half the time. A lot of times they won't even tell you their badge numbers. And then you're being charged and you want to know, oh, this guy, he kicked my ass before he arrested me. I want to know if he's got any other complaints, if other people have complained that he used excessive force before they arrested him. Well, we have to protect the officer's safety, so we can't tell you that. We can't tell you if he's a violent officer, if he's got a history of violence against other people.
Not only that. Like, I look at you funny, and you're a police officer, and, hey, where's your
probable identification? Cause.
I need to see my ID now. I need to see – give me your ID. Let me see your ID. Prove who you are. What are you doing around here? What's your plan today? What – this and that. Tell me the detail itinerary of your day so far. But do you need to know something – my badge number, my name? No. No, you can't have that. Do you need to know if I'm violent and have a history of violence against people that are in your position? Oh, no. That's top secret information. Right. You can't have that information. But, I mean, you looked at me funny, and so obviously I need to know every single detail about you and what you're doing and where you're going and where you've been. And if you're on drugs, off drugs, if you're drunk, not drunk, if you're, you know, if you've got a mole, how many moles do you have on your butt, left butt cheek? I need to know that. But you can't know anything about me. No. I'm just some random. But you see the badge, right? The badge tells you everything you need to know.
And you know what's interesting about that is, like, so I think this is, like, I mean, it's part of the, I don't know if it's the indoctrination by the DARE programs, the propaganda in TV and movies, but it's like, We're conditioned to believe that it's okay for them to have more rights than us because they've got a job to do and it's an important job. But what's really scary is that, like, you watch a lot of these TV shows and, you know, the cops are always playing this game and, you know, it's fun to watch. Okay, I used to like those movies too. Now I look at them and I'm like, fuck this. That cop just violated someone's Fourth Amendment right by breaking into their apartment.
Yep. And well, and that's conditioning, because all these TV shows, all these police dramas show police violating people's rights, violating, you know, the procedures that they're supposed to follow, and then seeing that there's no actual retribution for that. And so it teaches people that, yes, the cops can break their own rules. The rules are supposed to protect your rights, and because we, as the viewers, usually what happens is we know that the guy that they're violating, the guy whose rights are being violated, we know he did it, because it usually shows us right. that
they don't get, they don't ever get the wrong address.
It shows us, yeah, because we're watching a fictional show that has a different perspective than the individual cops. The individual cops at that, if you were to actually, like, break it down and
right,
say,
they don't
does
have that
individual cop
perspective that, like, yeah. like we know because we saw the crime happen in a different scene,
yeah.
and then the cops just know yeah. because of intuition and, oh, these are good cops.
Yeah, they got that gut feeling, man.
But yeah, it can and the thing is, like, allow it.
So it's teaching you that you see the bad guy and you know it, and obviously the cop knows it too because you saw it. And so even though no one could reasonably assume that police officer knows the person whose rights are being violated as actually the guy who did whatever crime, because we're conditioned to believe that when people's rights are being violated, we know that they've done something wrong. Next time, when you see someone's rights being violated, obviously you say, well, he probably did something wrong. don't do anything wrong and your rights won't be violated.
Right.
But the recent botched raid where essentially...
Cops don't make mistakes, man. It wasn't botched. It wasn't a botched raid. He did something wrong.
Well, no, so it was botched. It was botched because... And I'll argue this point. Because had there not been probably friendly fire... It was probably friendly fire. I remember they said that Tuttle had like a 357 revolver, but I don't remember hearing any actual reports of them finding that. I remember them saying that he had rifles and shotguns, but no revolver. I might be wrong. They might have found a revolver and just assumed that we knew this in the reports. But whenever you read the reports, they always mention rifles and shotguns, no actual handguns. But which, you know, they were shot with a 357. Maybe there was a cop that had a 357. Had they not been shot, and had there not been more attention given to that raid, the one officer that they're throwing, you know, under the bus would have had time to plant the heroin, and it would not have been a botched raid. It would have been a successful raid taking down a heroin kingpin. See, it's botched because they didn't get to plant the drugs.
Yeah. And that's fucking insane. And look, this is so Arvin Voro the other night on our debate was, you know, he was pointing out the importance of jury nullification, and I think that's like, I mean, he's right about that. That's absolutely necessary. And I know we got people like Sean Jones and Fija out there that are working really hard on that. But that's like, I mean, you have to, because when it's something, I mean, okay, look, let's look at murder, right? No police officer has that much of an incentive to say, we're going to catch a murderer, we're going to go raid this house, and we're going to bring a dead body and we're going to plant it. They don't do that.
Yeah.
But with drugs, no. And drugs is like, who gives a fuck? It's drugs. Like, everyone on the police force has tried them at some point. Every president we've ever had has tried them.
Half the cops are on drugs.
Steroids.
Like, when they say, if you don't like the police, call a crackhead. Well, guess what? I called the crackhead, 911.
And those drugs are so much more dangerous because they make you violent versus opium or heroin or weed,
yeah,
which, like, just chills you the fuck out. Like, the cops are on uppers, which is turning them into, like, violent maniacs. Not the
steroids.
The good cops, just the bad cops.
They're roid raging. I mean, there's nothing saying you can't be on steroids and be a cop.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if we can get jury nullification to be a big enough thing, then that takes away their incentive. Why are they going to go? Why are they going to do these raids and plant evidence and do all this other crap if all it's doing is resulting in their officers getting shot and all of the charges dismissed because jury nullification?
The problem is jury nullification works if there's a jury trial, but so many cases are plea bargained before they get to a jury trial.
True.
I mean, even if you stop a few, you're getting a couple, and that's great, and it's worthwhile. But it's a you know,
at the same time,
teaspoon and to.
I mean, like the courts are already, like, you know, they're overburdened, and you know, I was talking to who was I talking to about this? You know, like there are these fake judges there, and if you can get the fake judges, like. If everybody, whenever you're charged with a traffic ticket and you say, you know, I object to this judge, I want my case to be heard by a real judge. I've got mosquitoes flying around. My case must be heard by the judge. You're gonna jam up the court, right? And the court, because there aren't as many judges as they need to prosecute all these cases. And if you take your thing to trial, that's going to jam it up even more. Eventually, they're going to say, you know what? We're going to have to dismiss all these traffic tickets because we don't have the capacity to deal with them. And then you do the same thing with all the other cases, right? You have all your weed cases and everything, and you try them. You take them. You try them. And I know they threaten you out of it. But when they see that people are starting to do jury nullification more and more and more, then they're going to look at it like, okay, yes, 90% of the cases are plea bargains. But out of the 10% that go to trial, 95% of those cases get nullified. 95%, let's just leave this to marijuana charges, right? 95% of those cases get nullified. That means that, well, no, I guess if you plead guilty, you have 100% chance that you're going to be guilty, but you're going to take a smaller thing. But you might be able to say, look, I'm going to take this to trial because at least I have a 95% chance of getting off not guilty, which means no probation, no jail nothing.
That's if you know that you have that 95% chance. The reason why the plea bargains are so successful, it's because people are not aware of the percentage of times when people actually take it to court and actually win. That's the thing is the role of the prosecutors, especially when someone's been charged and arrested and they're, you know, going in, they've got their public defender or whatever, is to basically scare the person into pleading guilty so that they can get them on something. Funny thing, you mentioned getting traffic tickets dismissed. I just recently dealt with that earlier. Actually, end of January, I had a court date for a traffic ticket that I was allegedly going over 35 at some point, and it was dismissed. So, because I fought it.
Yeah, it's... And here's what's fucked up. I really need to keep this on my desk here, because I need to bring this. I almost bring this up every show, every time we talk about prosecutors and public defenders. This traffic ticket that I got in Nevada, and I just want to show this card right now. That's my case was literally dismissed. Everyone could have just said nothing, and my case was dismissed. And this guy gets up and he says, we really should take this to trial. And then the judge says, okay, it's back in the file. And then the guy who said we should take this case to trial turns around and gives me his card and says, I'm the public defender. and then I look at his card and it says Office of the Prosecutor, District Attorney, with his name written on it. And like the reality is, like, people don't understand this. They think that because the government loves us, it has given us public defense attorneys to protect our wonderful, beautiful rights that the government has bestowed upon us. But the reality is the Constitution prevents a prosecutor from raping you without a public defender. And so the prosecutor hires a public defender to sit around and watch while he rapes you. And later on, he can say, well, he had a defender. I don't know why his defender wasn't any good. It might be because he was overburdened with cases and because I don't pay him anything. But that's beside the point. He had an attorney. That's how they screw you. That's, like, it's so fucked up.
Well, for example, Nicholas Starwark was a public defender, and he is.
I mean, look, I won't say all public defenders are like that. There's, you know, I've had my share of courtroom experiences where, you know, I fought and, like, the judge and the prosecutor were totally against me. The judge was not unbiased at all. And a public defender who was not even on, like, on my case, was not even helping me, actually got up and said something in my favor. And I was like, thank you for that. But I already knew, like, you know, same story. She was already convincing all of her clients to plead guilty because she didn't have the time to do any research on any of those cases. And that's just because, like, you know, there's 1,000 cases that her boss is the DA.
Yeah.
The DA says, well, here's 1,000 cases. Go defend them. What the fuck are you going to do? Like, the reason a lawyer costs so much money is because he has to spend the time to dig up records on police and dig up records on, like, the street you're driving on and the records on the you know, everything, the tools that were used, the alcohol tests, the radar guns, the, you know, whatever. There's a lot of research involved. And if you've got 1,000,000 cases and you can't do it.
So Houston is a weird, almost like exception to that rule, because we do have municipal courts. So if you do get a traffic ticket, you do go to an actual court, you do go in front of a judge. But
how real is that?
We actually do have. So the judges are elected. I believe that they are elected officials.
You got to check.
It depends on.
This is where you have to check, because look, I can invite 50 people over to my house and we can have an election. If I have a city, I can put an election on the ballot. That doesn't mean that that person is a judge. You have to look at the state constitution and see what constitutes a judge. And sometimes they'll delegate it to a county, or the county will delegate it to a city, or the state constitution has to give a county the authority to delegate it to a city. Because a city is a corporation. It's a private it's a private business with some degree of publicity to it. But yeah, like they know what they're doing. Their entire purpose is to deceive you into thinking that their courts are real.
So,
but sorry, go ahead.
Well, so at least so like what ends up happening in our areas is that if you get like a traffic ticket, there's a couple different law firms that will send you out stuff, and they just mass represent clients. And so it's almost like a public defender in the sense of like, there's a lot of clients that they're representing, but they actually, you pay them essentially to fight it and put up the minimal effort that it takes to get them to dismiss your ticket.
And they're usually like, some of them are pretty cheap, right? Like $100 or something.
Oh yeah. $80, $50, something like that. Depending on what they have to actually end up doing. But it's usually like
pretty cheap. What's interesting about some of those guys is like, and this is kind of what's cool about them. Some of them, not all, because some of them, they're just there to take your money and then go in and plead guilty for you. There's actually like lawyers will do that on big cases too. They'll take like $10,000 from you and then tell you to plead guilty. But like with some of these traffic guys, they're actually their scam is like they just give the court a hard enough time on a couple of cases that whenever they come in with anybody, they're just like, okay, fine, fuck it, dismiss it, and they get good at that. But it's like, really, that's no justice. That's not a real system of justice. But at the same time, it's like they're charging people with non-crimes, so who gives a fuck? I want to bring attention to this. There's like this crazy like anti-Semite going off on like fucking whatever in the comments. I think he said something about he's got penis envy. So he's complaining about the size of my hat, and I just want to say, fuck you. I love my hat, and I'm not taking it off. All right. In other news.
I mean, is anyone here Jewish? I mean, Dan, are you Jewish? I don't know.
I'm a atheist Jew-ish. I'm Jew-ish.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of grew up with some of that stuff, but I've been questioning authority since I was 2 months old. I wanted to say like negative 2 months, but I don't know how much I could hear in there. Like seriously, I have been challenged. Like the first time I heard about taxes, I was like, "What the fuck? Are you crazy? Like, no, this is mine. I earned it. I don't have to give that up." And so, like, I heard about religion, and no disrespect to anybody who, like, I'm not one of these people that'll, like, come up to you and tell you, your religion's wrong, you need to be an atheist. That's totally not me. Like, I can totally appreciate the value that other people see in religion. And I'll even say this. I went to church. I don't go often. I went with a friend because he was going. He was volunteering there. And I went, and, like, I watched.
Did you burst in flame?
No. That was my fear for a while. But I watched, like, I listened to everything, and I was like, okay, like, I'm just gonna, I was like, okay, every time that, cause every other word was God and Jesus. And I was like, okay, I'm just gonna kind of skip over that part and listen to the actual content of what they're saying. And they were teaching a really valuable lesson. And I was like, this is fucking awesome. Look, everybody needs like, you know, they need to be uplifted because, like, man, our lives are fucking miserable, right? We go to work. We deal with all this crap. There's family drama, people getting sick. We've got all these problems to deal with. Like, I get it. Like, you know, I just don't believe in, like, the guy in the clouds with the big beard. And I know religion isn't all that. I know that's an oversimplification of it. But so I always challenge that, which is why I consider myself an atheist.
I think Facebook thinks I'm Jewish because I keep on getting advertisements for free trips to Israel. And I'm just like,
it's the beard, man.
Like, I mean, they're probably going to be like, are you Jewish? And I'll be like, no. And they're like, oh, no, it's not free for you. Because it's like the ones for, like, Jewish the youth birthright. To go yeah. visit Israel or whatever. And I'm just like, I'm not Jewish. Pastafarian, I guess we're about the same size.
To tell you the truth, like, I heard about that when I was younger, and I was like, yeah, that might be kind of cool, but somehow it never, like, manifested, right? But then, like, later as I got older and I actually started traveling, I was like, yeah, you know what? It might be kind of cool to go over there.
I mean, it'd be cool to go over there. But yeah. My thing is, like, they're advertising free trips for Jewish kids. And all I know is I'm going to sign up for it, and they'll be like, oh, wait, are you actually Jewish? You'd be like, you got me. And it has to be until we're on the plane and going there. They can't say no at that point.
Yeah.
Because of the implications.
No, it's – and it's really interesting too, because there's like – okay, so when I was a kid, my parents used to send me to temple all the time. We had like Sunday school and – I learned Hebrew. We had Hebrew school, and I did the bar mitzvah thing. And there was one kid there who was black, and that was like always kind of weird to me, because I was like, why is every Jew here white, and then this one's black? Like, because I could never, like, especially as a kid, right? Like, they tell you Judaism is not a religion; it's a race. You're not white, because I always thought of myself like I'm white, right? And like even stranger, like I remember in middle school, there was like, you know, everyone would start these like petty little race fights. And this one guy came to me and he was like, yeah, you fucking white boy. And I'm like, what are you talking about, man? You're white. And he was like, nah, I'm Mexican. And like that's how like it was to me. I was like, okay, well, because he was, I mean, shit, I was white as hell. I was pale. But this guy was really light skinned, but he's like, nah, I'm Mexican. So like that kind of never all made sense to me. I was like, well, are we white? No, we're not white. We're Jewish. What is that? Like, no, that's a religion, because you can decide not to be Jewish, right? You can, like, I heard of people converting to Judaism and you know, and I'm like, so how does this make sense? And then I hear there's like, okay, so in actual Jewish law, there's like this thing where you're not Jewish unless your mother is Jewish. So as long as your mother is Jewish, you're Jewish. If your father's Jewish and your mother's not Jewish, then you're not Jewish. And I'm like, well, that sounds very unscientific. Because 2/3 of your genes come from your mom, apparently. Yeah, I don't know. It's so there's just always been like weird stuff. And I'm like, okay, I question that. But at the same time, this is what I thought was really interesting. Like, especially getting into getting more into like the philosophical discussion with libertarians is, you know, there's like, yeah. What is it? The train question, right? If there's a train going and you flip the switch, if you don't flip the switch, it's going to kill 20 people. If you do flip the switch, it's going to kill one person. Right.
That's probably a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So when, what did you call it?
The trolley problem.
The trolley. I thought you had like a better, like a more broad term for it. Like it's kind of like an ethical dilemma.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like moral philosophy. It's like, it's
yeah.
essentially that there's a trolley going forward, and if you flip the switch, it kills one person. But if you don't flip the switch, it kills five people. And the idea is that, do you believe it's morally wrong to take the action to kill someone, or to do nothing and let five people die?
Right. And so in my, I guess it was my Sunday school, or yeah, I think I'm sure it was my Sunday school, because in Hebrew school, all we were learning was Hebrew.
Yeah.
Like, so we had conversations like that. And some of them were more like, you know, okay, if you're stranded on an island with 10 people, one of them's a doctor, one of them's an architect, one of them's, and they, you know, they start naming all these different professions, and they're like, and something happens and one of you has to die, or there's only enough food for eight of you and there's 10 of you, who's going to be the first one to die?
Yeah.
or you're stranded on a boat, or, you know, all kinds of different scenarios. And we actually had these discussions, and it was like, it was really interesting, because when we talk about, like, in the libertarian circle, we talk about, like, all these laws and property rights and all this other stuff. But the reality is, when survival's on the line, all that stuff kind of goes out the window. And it's like, is there ever, like, you can't ever say there's a right thing to do. It's like, at that point, it's like, oh my God, something must be done. Like, something has to be done. And what's it going to be? We're all in a shitty situation. None of us planned to be here. But now that we're here, what are we going to do? And it's going to hurt. Some people are going to get hurt. Some people are going to get killed. Like, but can we at least think about it to somehow minimize the damage? And that's a question that most people don't ask. Like, most people, like, ask, well, what does the law say about it? And some people don't even care about that. Some people are just like, well, I don't, like, some people are just like, well, I'm going to look out for myself no matter what. And I'm going to take care of my own needs. I don't give a fuck about, like, it's every man for himself. And they're kind of like in that mode, like, before anything ever gets started. So I don't know. I always thought that was, like, interesting types of discussions to have. That
well, so my thought is, of course, you know, whenever the happening happens, right? You know, when and like the government collapses and society's in a mess, don't come to my house.
Man. Okay, so I learned this from a prepper. You're not supposed to let anyone know you have a gun. Because now your house is going to be the first house that they go to so that they can get a gun, because they don't have one because they weren't prepared. They say, like,
good luck.
They say, like, don't wear NRA stuff specifically, because, I don't know, maybe they were just anti-NRA. Don't let people know you have guns. Wear neutral colors. Don't wear, like, bright orange hats, so that you can just kind of blend in.
I'm gonna say this, and this is probably gonna, you know, according to that prepper, probably get my house raided. But if you were to try to come to my house, if the happening happens, you're looking for a gun, I have the Biggie Smalls home protection plan. I've got Glocks in the bedroom, nines in the kitchen. I got a shotty by the shower in case you shoot me while I'm shitting.
Nice. All bases covered. And yeah. And I'm sure you have the place booby trapped.
Oh, of course. I don't want to say yes or no. I cannot confirm.
I'm not going to tell you where. Man. Yeah. Yeah. Let's hope it doesn't get to that. But yeah, that's always, like, it's funny. Like, it's always a believable plot when it's in a movie, but no, that could never happen in real life. I wonder if that's why they always pair it up with zombies to make it, like, unbelievable.
Well, so I remember hearing, and I was actually reading this article, and it was this guy who does, like, floodplains, right? And his thing is using the math that they use to determine what is and is not a floodplain and applying that to massive government collapses, right? And so he was looking at, because the way that, whenever they say, like, a 500-year floodplain or whatever, like a 100-year storm, it's not that this storm happens every 100 years. It's that in any given year you have a chance of, like, a 1% chance of this level of storm happening. Or in every given year you've got, like, this percent chance of it happening. And over time you're essentially due for something like that to happen because – you know, it is going to happen at a certain point. And he was talking about how applying that to, you know, the concept of massive societal disruption, upheaval, government collapse, it actually makes sense to prep. Like, mathematical sense.
Yeah, it's something just happened with the live stream. I think we might have been, oh no, it disconnected and then it came back. I think Facebook saw the anti-Semitic comments and they started going community standards on the stream, and then they were like, oh no, it's just the comments, so it came back. Yeah, no, that's a really an interesting way to look at it. Like, you know, anything like the stock market, like you do enough statistical analysis of that, it's like you've got over the past 100 years, you got so many peaks, so many valleys. Shit's gonna happen. It's gonna go up. It's gonna go down. There's gonna be another crash. That's just nature. And yeah. It's funny. We think like humans are so smart, but really like our behavior patterns are so predictable in the big picture that it's like, yeah, economies are going to collapse. Governments are going to collapse. It's going to happen all the time. Yeah. The United States is not immune from the laws of nature. It's going to happen. Well, and yeah, the longer we go without about, like, it. Like
collapse and like long-term, especially when it comes to like stock markets and investing, you know, some of the people that I listen to are big on belief in the idea of you can't time the market, right? Because essentially, like, there's going to be a collapse at some point. There's going to be a massive growth at some point. You just really can't figure it out. And so, like, I know a lot of people that I've been listening to talk about, like dollar cost averaging, where you just buy over time. And generally, I think they were saying you'll see like at least 8% over the life of your investment.
Right.
You know, given the peaks and valleys and everything.
Right. Yeah. It's like if you look at a graph and it's like it goes up and down, but over time it's always going up, then, you know, like probably, yeah. I don't know, the price of oil or something. I don't know. You buy it over time and like, yeah, it's going to go up. It's going to go down. It's going to go up. But yeah, if you're buying on all these different periods and you average where that price is, then yeah, I guess you want to just shoot for it. I mean, you know, obviously there's crap that you can buy. You could buy stock in Atari. you can do the price average on that, and that's never going to be good.
They were saying buy into like index funds that kind of cover the entire market.
Right.
Because it's like you mentioned, like buying into one segment, buying into one industry. Like if you bought into Atari and you put all your money into Atari, it's going to be not worth anything. Or Blockbuster. If you bought stock in Blockbuster, you're kind of shit out of luck. But yeah, like if you bought over the entire, you gotta diversify.
Now at the same time, there was an interesting study that says you have if you threw darts at the stock chart and you picked your stocks that way, you would average higher than the S&P 500. Probably. And then there's some weird other statistics out there. Like the S&P 500 does better than all of the mutual funds that are out there over time. So you might as well just bank on that.
Yeah.
I think it does worse. I don't know. There's some like weird comparisons that you can do that, you know, that says mutual funds are no good, that the S&P and all the indexes are no good. It's really interesting, but like, yeah, this is what I thought was interesting, because there's a lot of people talking about like the UBI right now, right? The universal basic income.
Yeah.
And you know, this one guy's talking about it and he says, because all the jobs are going to be gone in a few years, right? Everything's being replaced by automation. Nobody's going to have any jobs. The reality is, like, I see that as, you know, there was a gold rush, right? Before there was gold, I mean, well, there was gold before, but before the gold rush, nobody was like crazy over gold. It was just like, okay, it's money, whatever. Then there was a gold rush. Oh my God, let's go get it. And everybody was like, oh, obsessed with this, right? We have to get it. And then once it died out, everybody was like, oh, it's over. What are we going to do? Now, some people were probably just stuck in the mountains like, oh, no, there has to be more. And they wasted the rest of their lives looking for the rest of the gold. Some people are doing this with Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin came along. Oh, it's going to go up. Now that it's down, everyone's like, oh, I'm going to buy more because I know it's going to come back. It's going to go to 100,000. I'm sure McAfee is still like hoping it's going to go back up. He doesn't want to have to eat his own dick. Like these, everything works in bubbles. And if you look at jobs are a relatively new concept. Like they've only been around for a few hundred years, right? I mean, there's always been trade, but there hasn't been this concept of trading your time for money that you would take to a completely separate place to buy a house and buy food and like all this other stuff. Like that's really kind of a new concept. And the need for this came about because people were like, okay, well, we have all these big farms and we don't have enough labor to farm these farms. So we need to convince people, well, I'll give you this money. And then, you know, this is what you do. And so they created this whole system. And now that's all being replaced by automation. So there's no need for jobs. It's just another bubble that's going to go away. Big fucking deal. We survived before jobs. We'll survive after jobs. Now, the question is, this is where it gets really interesting, right? Because they talk about, you know, oh, well, all these greedy capitalists are going to have all these big corporations that are going to be completely automated and nobody's going to have any jobs. Nobody's going to have any money. And we're all going to be screwed and we're going to die, right? But if you think about it, okay, picture this, right? One person.
If no one has any money, no one has a job, no one has any sort of income, how are they going to buy the goods that those greedy capitalists are creating?
Exactly. Like picture a world where like one guy literally owns all of the farms in the entire world and he doesn't have a single employee because it's all done by automation.
Yeah.
Who's he going to sell all that food to, realistically? Now, here's another interesting point. How is he going to protect those farms? Because we have this idea of, you know, no man's land, right? Unclaimed property. There's just food, right? Like, there's food in nature. There's plenty of food anywhere. Anyone can go pick up a piece of land and start growing their own food. That's kind of what people did before there were jobs, before there was a sort of a mutual exchange. Now, If this one guy is owning this, how's he going to protect all this property? I mean, maybe he could build some machines, but what's the point in that? Like, he's going to build machines to protect all this property so that he can hoard all this food that he's never going to eat just so he can watch the rest of the world. It doesn't make any sense. So what's going to happen is this automation is just going to make all the food ridiculously cheap, and he's going to say, okay, look, I can't sell all this food for $1 million, but I can sell all this food for, you know, pennies, like, whatever, tiny, tiny little increments of whatever, and people will figure out, okay, well, I'm going to create art, and that art has a value, and they'll trade the art. I'm going to build a house, and it's not going to be a house by automation. It's going to be something that I built on my own, and I'm proud of. I have pride of ownership. I built it.
Or like, even just, I'm going to design the house for the automation to build, right?
Yeah.
And I created that design. I created the concept. But even if they automate that, like, I mean, there's so much for us to do. Like
needing a job and being able to survive because all the food is brought to you through automation. Like, it's
you think about it, like what the, you know, guys that were blacksmiths end up doing after the Industrial Revolution. Well, a lot of them became the mechanics that service the machines in the Industrial Revolution that created all the stuff that they used to make, you know, by hand. Now it's making it on a massive scale, and now you can produce way more doing essentially the same thing, using the skills you've already acquired to just become way more productive. All automation is going to do is increase productivity. I mean, when you increase productivity, you increase the standard of living for everyone. Yes, there's going to be some people that are going to be hyper wealthy, and you're going to be like, oh my God, look at these, the 1%, like, fuck them. But you have to understand, like, even you're eventually when the productivity like that, it spikes so much, you know, your life is going to be so much better than it would have been otherwise, but you're not going to even essentially realize it. Because
you can't compare your life. That's like part of the big problem. Everyone compares their life and their success to other people, but it's like, look at yourself and compare yourself to a king who lived 500 years ago. You're doing pretty fucking good.
Compare someone today that's living in poverty to just 1% from, you know, like 80 years ago. Look at, like, someone, just, let's say, like, just straight up 100 years ago, someone who's super rich
in the 1920s and compared to someone who's poor today, considered poverty level today. I mean, you've got refrigeration that keeps your food food fresh for longer, right? You've got more food, but, you know, like all sorts of different, you know, foods that didn't exist at that time.
Microwave ovens, TV. You can afford entertainment through your television, which is practically free, that only the elites, yeah, only the kings could afford back then.
Hell, you can get rabbit ears and get over-the-air stuff that is essentially free. I mean, you buy a rabbit ears antenna and you have a TV, and as long as you have that, you've got entertainment constantly, 24/7. You've got, you know, a phone that has entertainment and has connection to every single amount of information that exists out there. And it's for the price, you know, $50 today, and you think about, like, at the rate of inflation at the, let's say, from the 20s, you know, I think there were, I remember hearing it was like $100 now, it was like $20 then. So $10 in 1920 will get you a phone plan on Boost Mobile. And if you sign up, you get a free phone. It may not be the nice phone, but it's free. It's probably nicer than someone had in the 20s, right?
And they're all, like, the cost of that is going down so much. It's insane, especially because here's the thing, like, the way the phone market works is they're selling, they're always trying to sell new phones. They got to come up with a new one every year, and they're going to sell like another 100 million every year. Well, what does that really mean over the course? If they're selling 100 million new phones every year, over the course of 10 years, that's a billion phones. Like, the entire world is going to have it, have these phones. They're selling more than 100 million every year, I'm sure. And there's a trickle-down effect with it. Like, and what's interesting is we don't see that here in the U.S. Sorry, there in the U.S. Because everybody has to buy something new. The secondhand market in the U.S. is not that big. But a lot of used technology gets exported into foreign countries, which means while Apple and Samsung are selling all their brand-new computers and phones in the U.S., all of the old technology, which isn't even that old at this point. I mean, you look at an iPhone that's a couple years old, it's being exported to India or Africa or China for a secondhand market. And now you have poor people who have, you know, in third world countries who don't have clean drinking water, who have shiny new iPhones with access to YouTube videos on how to filter water that they're pulling out of the ground. Like, amazing technology.
Oh. And it's look at healthcare. I mean, you think about 100 years ago, what were people concerned about? A massive flu epidemic that killed tens of millions of people around the world, because essentially it was the fallout of World War I. I mean, you know, but today, you know, and I know some libertarians are going to kill me on this one, but
vaccines.
You don't have to worry about your child getting these diseases because you can vaccinate against them. And we have the vaccines. You don't see kids with polio anymore. Like, FDR doesn't exist. Like, lost the ability to walk because of polio. I mean, that doesn't happen anymore.
Right.
Because we have medical technology. We've got, like, even like you were mentioning with food becoming cheaper and cheaper, genetically modified organisms are already driving down the cost of food
GMOs, man.
Oh, it creates so much more productivity out of the same land. We have basically told Malthus, who I think is one of the most anti-libertarian thinkers ever, Malthus and Hobbes, those guys are assholes. We have basically proven them wrong. We've proven, especially Malthus, the Malthusian, his whole concept was that populations grow exponentially, but crop yields grow linearly, like where you add so your populations continue to grow and grow and grow, but you can only add the crop yields by adding another field of, like, let's say you have corn, which is a staple crop. You can add another field of corn, and then suddenly you have the yields from one
one field of corn, and then you suddenly have the yields of two fields of corn, and then three, and then four, and then five. But we've basically, through agricultural technology, destroyed that. And we've created a system that exponentially grows, like, our crops. And that's actually coming back to, like, Norman Borlaug. In the 70s, basically the Malthusians were saying, look, we've got this food crisis. All these people in the third world, they're going to starve. We told you we need population control. And then Norman Borlaug steps up and says, wait a minute. And basically starts genetically modifying organisms. And then suddenly the crop yields start growing up, and all these people that are on the brink of starvation are pulled back from it and are actually on the path to becoming not only just away from starvation, but destroying the concept of poverty. Currently, there's like a golden rice, which is one of the big things that's being developed by a couple of universities. And like the whole concept is that because rice is a staple crop in a lot of poor societies, but also they have a problem of vitamin A deficiency, make rice that creates vitamin A. And so then, because vitamin A deficiencies cause like sight, people going blind, you can basically stop that problem by just making the food that they're already eating more nutritious, right? So we're creating more nutritious foods with better crop yields, with more, so there's more food that feeds you better.
So this is kind of off topic from that, but it's kind of related. I don't know if you're watching the stream, but I've got a map of Venezuela up right now, and I'm going to turn this into satellite view, and I just want to show this to you because, so Venezuela is, people are starving, right? It's a third world mess, yeah. Right? Shit's going crazy. I guess this is kind of how I got here from what you were talking about is,
yeah,
you know, population grows, if population grows exponentially and agriculture grows linearly, then at some point population would pass the food production, and that would mean that people are starving. But the reality is the way it works is, you know, when you have more people, you're able to produce more food. So either the food can grow exponentially because you have more people who can produce it, and
Malthus's point was not necessarily that there wouldn't be the labor supply to create the food, but simply the arable land to grow the food on. So, his essential premise has been kind of destroyed is that instead of focusing on creating more arable land to grow more food, it's how to use the arable land that already exists to become more productive, to where one field of whatever crop you're growing produces more to feed more people. Today, the problem that we're running into, like you mentioned in Venezuela, is the problem of how do we get that food to people that need it. So essentially, when you see poverty in our current state, it's not an issue of there's not enough to go around. It's an issue of the governments that are over these people are using poverty as a tool of coercion to keep them under their control.
Exactly. And so this is kind of what I wanted to point out here. And so as I'm zooming around this map, I've got it on satellite view, and we can see like there's some land that looks like they've got some really cool beaches over here that look like really nice. Oh, yeah. But you've got plenty of land over here that looks appropriate for agriculture. Some of it looks like it's got some agriculture on it. This right here, maybe not. Or maybe they just took a picture. I don't know. When you zoom out, it looks pretty green. But when you zoom in, it looks pretty brown. But you can see it's got like all the squares in it. Like it's all agriculturable. All agricultural.
Yeah.
But like this, look at the size of these cities. Like you can see a city here. You can see
This is Caracas here, the capital. It's really small compared to all this green land around it. And like, yeah. Okay, I get it. It's mountains. There's a lot of mountains. There's a lot of green land. That means like you could grow a lot of fruit on here. There's plenty of stuff that grows well on hills and mountains. But yeah, it's exactly that. We're not anywhere near the point where we can't produce the food. Like, we have a problem of government just totally, like, fucking with economic systems, which make it difficult to trade. Which makes it difficult for resources to get around where they want to go.
Have you heard of the Holodomor? It was basically a forced starvation in the Ukraine and the Soviet Union. I say the Ukraine because at the time it was if it's part of the Soviet Union, it's called the Ukraine. If it's separate, it's Ukraine. So at the time, the Ukraine was basically forced into starvation. But it wasn't a problem that they weren't producing enough food. Ukraine, you know, today and back then has a lot of great – I mean, essentially it is part of the grasslands that extend past the Caucasus Mountains into Europe, right? It has a lot of land that is great for kind of almost kind of like basically, you know, you think about like the Midwest, right? It has kind of that a similar at least climate to that. So they produce a lot of wheat. They can produce a lot of food and food crops, but they were forced into starvation by the Soviets because they basically said, okay, all this food you're producing, yeah, we're going to take it and we're going to give it to everyone else. And we're going to force you to starve because we don't like you. That's the thing. It's authoritarian governments are using poverty as a tool to coerce people that they don't want to have power. That's the thing. Like that's the issue. I remember a few years ago they were talking about there was like this Poverty Inc. talking about even like NGOs like these massive charity, you know, things that are meant to help people in developing nations. And I remember they were talking about how, you know, the way that our charity works is we, especially coming from the US, is we go in and we give them stuff. And the issue is, like, I remember the guy that was talking about it, because I think he was like the director of it. He was saying, it's not like, don't just give them stuff. Like, that doesn't work, because that's a disaster model. If a hurricane comes in and wipes out your, you know, ability to go to work and go be productive, the right response is to go in and give you supplies so that you can survive until you can be connected back up and running. If you're in poverty like that, it's not even a question of they don't know how to get out. 'Cause the next response logically is, well, obviously you got to teach a man to fish. You know, you give a man a fish, but then you got to teach a man to fish. But it's not even a question of teach a man to fish. They know how to fish. They know how to be people in these developing countries know how to create, you know, productive work that has value. The question isn't whether you need to give the man a fish or teach a man to fish, but give him access to the pond. And the pond is things like markets, because if you cannot be connected, our world is so interconnected today that connectivity to the broader global markets ends up producing so much wealth and in amplifying whatever wealth producing things you're already doing to the point that, you know, you can't be poor anymore. Not in the level. We have to redefine what it is to be poor, because the concept of grinding poverty essentially is going away. That's why a lot of people on the left are switching away from talking about people that are, you know, going without to the inequality of what we have now. Because we're producing and creating and growing so much that it's not a question of people simply lack the ability to feed, clothe, house themselves. It's a question of, well, their food, their clothing, their housing isn't as nice as yours.
Right. And, you know,
but
that's also a really good point about, and we actually, I gotta run soon because I gotta do a conference call on this. We're going way over today. But so like, you know, going back to the question of what happens when some crazy billionaire automates all the food production for the entire world and there's no jobs, so there's no money. Well, what's going to stop a group of 50 people from who live in a remote location from just saying, we're going to fish?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, like...
That's the thing.
And, yeah, so...
Well, wait. Do they have a fishing license? Do they have fishing licenses, Dan? I don't know. They need a permit to get a fishing license.
So,
you got to have a boat permit, fishing license. You got to have, like... You got to have your set up as a corporation so you can pay your income taxes for your people, for your fishermen. You know, are they W-2 or 1099, Dan? I gotta know, because otherwise it depends on their tax rates and how they're gonna have to pay.
That really points out that it's not the billionaire that we need to be afraid of. It's
government.
It's the government.
And I remember, you know, a lot of people talk to people that are libsocks, and I'm full on bought immunity. So I mean, I don't agree with them, but I believe that they have the right to exist. A lot of people say, well, you know, if you want a libertarian socialist society, why don't you go out and do it? Well, property taxes. If I go out and homestead if there's homesteadable land, the government owns it. And they're going to kick you off for trespassing on their property that they own for you. But let's say you don't. You find some other property. Let's say you even get the money to buy it, right? Suddenly, you are a property owner. You have to pay property taxes. And you are obligated to pay property taxes every single year. And you need, if you want to completely shut yourself off from the... I'm saying you're gonna do it because there's a guy with a gun that's gonna tell you, pay the property tax or we're kicking your ass off. It's not a question of whether they have the right to do it; they have the might to do it.
I think it's I think it's also the desire, and that really depends on, you know, how nice the land is that you pick. Because I saw this in California, of all places, too. Right? They'd be the first ones to kick someone out.
Yeah.
They found this like shithole desert, and they created this like anarchist society where they do everything there. Like, nobody has any money there, but at the same time, they kind of live like bums. I'm not going to say they have the cleanest of environments and all this other stuff, but, so it's interesting, but yeah, I don't know. That's a whole other topic with the Libsox, but you're right. You're right to an extent. Like, yeah, the government is always there. Like, that's,
And they will
for that to exist.
Yeah, because they want you to, again, like I mentioned, it may not be to the same degree as these developing countries with their small despots that are going to prevent people from having access to markets. But even when the guy is a very respectable Washington politician versus, you know, someone being a warlord in some third world country, I mean, They all are the same. They all want to control you. That's the point. Like, they're in government to control you. They want to control other people. Like, that's the entire point.
Right. Why would they want to do that? Well, let's see. Let's look at their lifestyle. Let's look at how luxurious it is. And
because mommy didn't love the children.
Yeah. No, they have that luxurious lifestyle, and it's why? Because they control other people to do all the economic activity, and then they just sit up top and take the result of that economic activity for themselves, so that they can live lavish lifestyles. That's exactly what it is, and it all starts with control. Because if we all stop working and we all stop giving them tax, well, there goes their life of luxury. And if we did do that and there was no money, well, how would they keep that? They'd control people by taking slaves and having people build things for them and all these other things. That's really why, you know, a lot of people say that taxation is wage slavery, because it's you're providing things for people who really don't deserve the benefit of what you work so hard for. It's true. And taxation is theft.
Taxation is theft.
Oh shit, my camera just froze up again. It was doing this a lot yesterday. Anyway, I got to get running because I got a campaign call after this, because I'm running for president in 2020. And in case you didn't know. And yeah, man. Go ahead.
Well, I think I'm going to do this here. I am going to be forming an exploratory committee.
All right.
To possibly run in 2020 for sheriff of Harris County.
Nice. We could use a new sheriff.
Hey.
All right. Good. I'll put a few bucks on that campaign.
Nice.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, it's been a pleasure as always. And if you want to plug anything, I know you can't see it. I've got your theonlyreallibertarian.com up on the screen. So everyone's been going there, I'm sure.
Yeah. Remember, if you go to The Only Real Libertarian, take the survey, the quiz to find out if you are the only real libertarian. And also, there's a really kick-ass merch store there. You can get all your The Only Real Libertarian merchandise.
Absolutely. Go do it. And as usual, go to taxationstheft.cards to get hats and stickers and t-shirts and all kinds of other cool stuff. And Behrman2020.com, Behrman2020.com, to donate to my campaign or volunteer. And taxation is theft, isn't it? All right, man. It's been awesome, and we'll talk again soon.
Definitely, man. Thank you.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
Rhodes!